G'day, beloved listeners. Welcome to the Little Wireless Program. And I must say, our new theme has been greeted warmly. Great response to Giuseppe Brescianello's Violin Concerto in E Minor, performed by the Brandenburg Orchestra. The Koch brothers, whom we've oft discussed, give philanthropy a bad name. Every dollar, and they lavish countless millions of dollars on conservative politics, every dollar is targeted to have a profound political effect. We'll be looking at it in even closer detail a little later with Jane Mayer, staff writer with New Yorker, who's written a book called Dark Money: How a Secretive Group of Billionaires is Trying to Buy Political Control in US, and in fact they're getting it. And I have to say that as you read her book and think of the implications of the Koch brothers' activities, you can see that there's a ripple effect occurring even here in Australia. A question: how well have British Muslims integrated? It's raised much debate in recent weeks. Britain's former chief of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, Trevor Phillips, presented a television doco and published a booklet which made much of a recent survey to find out, yes, what British Muslims really think. Now, the survey revealed a very strong streak of social conservatism, with more than 100,000 British Muslims reporting that they sympathise with suicide bombers and people who commit other terrorist acts. Only 18% of Muslims thought that homosexuality should be legal. 4 in 10 thought wives should always obey their husbands, etc. Trevor Phillips wrote that the poll reveals the unacknowledged creation of a nation within a nation, with its own geography, its own values, and its own very separate future. Now, to gauge the response of this, I'm joined now by two high-profile Brits. Oh, heavens above, I've just been told they've both turned up. There were great difficulties with London traffic. Kenan Malik is a writer, broadcaster, columnist. He trained in neurobiology and he's written regularly about the meaning of race. And his latest book is The Quest for a Moral Compass: A Global History of Ethics. And our long-time regular, Yasmin Alibi Brown, MBE. Yasmin is a Ugandan-born British journalist, columnist and author, and founder of British Muslims for Secular Democracy. And we spoke a little earlier this year to Yasmin about her book Refusing the Veil, where she outlined her alarm at the spread of a misogynistic version of Islam around the world. Yasmin, welcome back, and thanks for joining us, Ken. Yasmin, do you agree with this ICM research survey and Phillips' comments that a significant part of the British Muslim community is becoming a separate nation within a nation?
Okay, I'll go into that question, but can I just make one correction, because it's important to me? I returned my MBE over the Iraq War, so I don't have that honour, which I didn't want anyway. So just to make sure people know, I don't have an MBE. To answer your question, it's there was a lot of controversy that blew up after Trevor Phillips's programme. I was actually interviewed for the programme. And I know that there have been problems with the wording of the survey. I'm not a social researcher, so I can't comment on that, but he touched on something which needed to be said, because it is true and it is happening. And it is happening with people, you know, this is the breaking the story of migration, if you like, amongst the young, the ones who were born here, a rejection of any accommodation or modernism, or modernity, really, modernity and modern values. It's happening. We aren't talking nearly enough about it. Obviously, not every Muslim is like that. But I have seen it grow. And so, in a way, I'm glad it was on the program, which was a very flawed program. There is self-segregation now, which is a different thing from discrimination that used to be suffered by many minorities before, you know, ghetto housing and all of that. I'm talking about actual separation within the nation. Some white people are doing it too. So, you know, it's not a particular, but it is within the Muslim kind of groupings that I see it, hear it, and witness it.
Kenan, a nation within a nation?
I think the results of the poll are in keeping with previous polls. There have been a number of polls which have shown similar kinds of results, have shown, as you say, a deep well of social conservatism within Muslim communities. But we also need to be careful about how we interpret the poll. And I have real trouble with the way that, say, Trevor Phillips and many of the commentators read the poll. Trevor argues that Muslims don't want to change, but still hold views from their ancestral backgrounds. In fact, the real problem is the opposite. British Muslims have changed, but many by becoming more socially conservative. If you'd taken this poll 30 years ago, it would probably have found very different results, because there's been a historical shift within Muslim communities. You know, the first generation of Muslims who came to Britain in the 1950s to 1960s were religious, but wore their faith pretty lightly. Many men drank alcohol, went out the pub, few women wore the hijab, let alone the niqab or burqa. Most visited mosques only occasionally. The second generation, which is my generation, was primarily secular, and our struggles were defined by political belief, not by a desire for cultural separation or religious separation. And ironically, it's only the third generation that's come of age, in a sense, since the late 1980s, for whom the question of cultural differences and religious differences and religious fundamentalism has become so important. The generation that is ironically, in many ways, far more integrated and westernized than that first generation is also the generation that is most insistent on maintaining its difference. You know, we talk a lot about the Muslim community. Before the 1980s, nobody thought of themselves as living in a Muslim community. That's a relatively recent construct. So the question really to ask is not why haven't Muslims changed, but why have so many changed, but in a more socially conservative direction? That's the more important question. If we can't ask the right question, it's not surprising we can't find the right answers.
I need to go back on that point I made about the 100,000 Muslims who expressed some sort of support for terrorism. We're talking about a total of 3.5 million Muslims, so even that high figure represents a tiny percentage of the total population.
It does, and if you compare that to what the poll showed about a general population, it showed, for instance, that 2% of the general population supported an Islamic caliphate and 1% appeared to back Islamic State. So I'd be wary about reading too much into those figures. It is certainly true that the poll shows real problems or real illiberalism about issues such as homosexuality, about women's rights, and so on. But the figures on the margins, I'd be more wary about.
I think you'd find similar degrees of homophobia if you polled Anglicans in Sydney. Now, Yasmin, how do we understand these tensions when we look across at your country and marvel at the fact that there was a backlash to the clearly racist campaigns for the morality of London, and here we have a Muslim mayor.
Yeah, and that's extraordinarily important to remember, that human nature and how we think and how we feel about each other in a very complex and mixed democracy can't be boxed into one set of behaviours or another. I was incredibly happy, especially as most of the right-wing press, including the only London paper, was shockingly prejudiced in its coverage But I want to return to what Kenan said briefly, which is, yes, people changed in, like I said, the immigration story has been broken here because the old immigration story goes in one direction. You know, the parents are much more conflicted about their values. They are still tied to their homelands, have confused feelings about, you know, where they belong. Second generation feels a little bit more, experiences racism. But even so, it's laying down the claim. And then by the third generation, in some senses, there has been real settlement. But this has gone the other way. Where I think an issue he hasn't touched on is that the changes we now see have come as a result of a number of newish forces. I don't think in the 80s everybody was as kind of contented as he's saying, because there were signs of forces coming in. But in the last decade, the influence of Wahhabi Islam, which has spread really across the world, needs to be taken on board, needs to be understood. So the imams in the mosques, who once were, as Kenan said, you know, kind of very mild and happy enough, you know, with how Muslims were living, we now have even British trained imams, very hard line on what a real Muslim is and what a real Muslim does. That's changed a lot of behaviours, I think.
Kenan Phillips is pretty good at coining phrases. He argues that Britons have understood too much and challenged too little. That will resonate with many critics of multiculturalism here.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, there's lots I do disagree with Trevor Phillips on that. I don't disagree. And I have for a very long time been a critic of multiculturalism. But when we talk about multiculturalism, we need to distinguish between two things. One is the lived experience of diversity. The other is multiculturalism as a set of political policies, the aim of which is to manage that diversity. I think that the experience of living in a society that's less insular, more vibrant, more cosmopolitan, is positive, and hence I welcome mass immigration. But as a political process, multiculturalism seems means something very different. It describes a set of policies, the aim of which is to manage diversity by putting people into particular ethnic or cultural boxes.
Well, how might it be better managed?
Thinking of people not as simply as members of a particular group, but as British citizens. I mean, going back to what Yasmin's point, I think there are a number of changes that have taken place over the past 20 or 30 years, which account for the shift in the social attitudes of many Muslims. There's a tangled set of social and political changes, from the erosion of the weight of the left to the rise of identity politics. There are international developments. The Bosnian War, for instance, was in the early 1990s, was very important in establishing a heightened sense of Muslim identity. Partly the line what Yasmin was talking about, the influence of Saudi Arabia on Islamic institutions in the West and the aggressive promotion of Wahhabism. And partly they lie in the promotion, the development of multicultural social policies that have exacerbated the worst aspects of identity politics and helped to fragment society. So I think there's a number of different issues that are at play here.
Yasmin, how might multiculturalism be better managed?
Well, I think, I honestly think we need to talk about a good society. Too often, I feel, you know, in countries dominated by white power, there is an eagerness to blame the other, the outsider. The good society, which we all want to live in, does entail telling our interrelated and sometimes unequal histories. The good thing about the multicultural movement, if you like, in the UK, which started in Thatcher's era, Margaret Thatcher was selling off the assets of this country to whoever came from wherever and had the biggest wallet, but at the same time was a petty nationalist. And she really pushed this idea of little England, you know, the country being swarmed by other cultures and all of this. And the only resistance at that time, there were two kind of, if you like, armies of resistance, cultural armies of resistance to that. And they kind of worked well as alternative forces. And one was, for example, multiculturalism forced through in schools a curriculum which told a better history of colonialism than had been told, you know, which wanted children to have a fuller history, a history that included the black experience, literature which included the black experience. So we had education authorities and local authorities which promoted this. It was the only way we could resist the Thatcher pressure. And then there was a very strong, united anti-racist movement of white, black, every religion. Kenan was part of it. I was part of it. The religion didn't matter. In some ways, colour didn't matter. It was a political movement, as was the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. And so there was a point at which multiculturalism was necessary. But then it did become what Kenan said, you know, the whole taking over of the idea that we were these separate boxed creatures. And that's where, but also this was a colonial model, you know, power did it for its own reasons. For as long as we were divided off and still are divided off, and I do blame some Muslims for this too, because they refuse to be part of the broader political movement.
We see, Yasmin, you can say that because you're Yasmin. People in this country, just as people feel in Britain, are terribly concerned about saying the wrong thing. So let's look at this issue, because Phillips says that we should not restrict speech because it causes offence, that the only speech that incites violence should be prohibited. Has the restriction of speech been a large part of the problem within Britain? I put that to you, Kenan.
I think it's been the consequence, in a sense, of the way we look at multiculturalism. It's been the consequence of thinking that because we live in a multicultural society, a plural society, so we need to be have less freedom in speech, and we mustn't offend other people, and that the idea that one must not give offence to other groups has become so deeply embedded in our communities. And it's a real problem. It's a real problem because, to me, the giving of offence in a plural society is both inevitable and necessary. It's inevitable because, by definition, a plural society is where you have different peoples with different views deeply held, and it's better to have those conflicting views out in the open than to suppress those differences in the name of respect or tolerance. But more importantly, I also think it's important to offend other people, because any kind of social change requires us to offend some social group or other. And the idea you can't say that, the claim that you can't say that, is all too often used by those with power when their power is challenged.
That's one of the reasons we keep inviting Yasmin back on the program over and over again over the years, is because of your courage, Yasmin, because you really put your head way above the battlements, and your enemies in this in these discussions are, of course, fellow Muslims.
And, oh, not only fellow Muslims, no. My enemies, fortunately or unfortunately, come from right across the spectrum. I get death threats from white racists. I get the most horrendous reactions when I write about Israel. I seem to be a self-loathing Muslim, an anti-Semite, a hater of my nation, and a traitor, all in one, you know. So, and I do think that I mind very much that when we talk about freedom of expression, we pick on certain groups, right? And you know, I think Kenan is right. We should be able to have open conversations.
Kenan, we're running out of time. I'd like
to. But I think we should also then say, we in this country, our speech is being curtailed by new anti-terrorism laws. It's increasingly difficult to criticize Israel. Young Muslims see that and point out, why is it when we talk about freedom of speech, they pick on us, when all the time freedom of speech is being curtailed?
Can I just say on that, it's true that there are double standards when it comes to speech, but there are two ways one can deal with double standards. We can deal with double standards by restricting speech for everyone, or we can deal with double standards by enlarging speech for everyone. My point is that we should deal with double standards by extending free speech, and everyone should have the right to be able to criticise, to offend others. We can. Otherwise, what we're saying is that we don't want to live in a plural society.
But Kenan Phillips, Phillips makes a point. Sorry, Phillips makes a point that we overuse the term racist. Do you agree with that?
Sorry, I missed that.
Well, we're out of time, really. But Phillips expresses concern at the overuse of the term racist.
I would agree with that. I think that it's been used too freely. And that it's become a matter of condemnation of people whose views you don't like. Quite often you dismiss them as racist, rather than having a proper discussion, debate about their views.
I'd like to thank you both for your clarity and indeed your courage. Yasmin, wonderful to hear from you again. Yasmin Alibi Brown, who made it through the traffic just in time, journalist, columnist and author. Of considerable note, as is Kenan Malik, writer, broadcaster and columnist. A useful discussion. Coming up, we're going to look at the dark side of philanthropy in the US of A by focusing on those appalling Koch brothers. Beloved listeners, we return to the Koch brothers, Charles and David. Been discussing them for years, but tonight we're going to see them up close and personal thanks to the courageous investigative work of Jane Mayer. The Koch brothers, their vast network of political influence groups has been called the Kochtopus. It's been promoting their radical libertarian agenda for the last few decades. But although they're shaping American life at many levels, few ordinary punters actually have heard of them because they have tried to keep their work pretty secret. Well, no longer. Jane has written a highly celebrated work. It's a story which takes us into the belly of the beast. And as well, we meet a group of their staggeringly wealthy friends. It's a story the brothers didn't want told. They hired investigators to dig up dirt on Jane Mayer, but she persisted, and her investigation has unravelled more of their shadowy world than has ever been known before. Jane's an award-winning journalist, a staff writer at New Yorker, and her book, which has become a New York Times bestseller, is called Dark Money: The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And she joins our little wireless program from New York. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you so much.
The Kochs and their friends have been working on transforming American politics for decades. What do you see as their greatest successes?
Well, they have had a tremendous effect at levels of politics that people don't watch that much in the U.S. Local politics, state houses, legislatures, and eventually they've worked their way up to Congress, where their effect can be measured most in terms of environmental policy. Of all the issues they've been working on, they've been trying to stop the Congress from doing anything about global warming because of the nature of their fortune, which is in fossil fuels. And so they've developed a pledge. It's a piece of a statement that congressmen sign, and if they want to get any money and backing from the Kochs and their organization, they have to sign something saying they'll do basically nothing about global warming.
And well, walking it back a bit, Jane, would it be an exaggeration to say that they really were essential to the growth of the Tea Party?
Oh, well, they were certainly important to the growth of the Tea Party. What they have been doing, and it's not just me asserting this, but Richard Fink, who's one of their top people, has said every time Obama has encountered opposition, if you turn over the rock, we're there. And they're very proud of it. And in particular, the Tea Party was a high point for them. So there was real anger in the streets because of our economy being in such a downturn at that point. But what the Kochs and their organization did was organize it and give it shape and give it specific policies and turn it against Obama in that way. So
whilst there's been some recent mutterings from the Kochs which seem vaguely ambivalent on Trump, he's certainly a ventriloquial doll on climate change, isn't he? He's made the most preposterous public utterances from a very lofty position.
He's right where they are on it. The thing that's interesting is the entire Republican Party is in that position. The orthodoxy of the party is that you have to deny that either climate change is real or that it matters. And so this is because of the fossil fuel money going into the Republican Party, and of that money, a substantial amount comes from the Kochs. They've really directed this denial movement, not just in people running for office, but in all of the scholarship, all the fake science they've helped fund.
Well, in 2012, they paid what was then the largest fine in history, $30 million for violating the Clean Water Act. And you remind us they were listed as the largest producer of toxic waste in the nation. That's a great achievement.
Well, they've topped lists again and again for pollution of various sorts, air, water, and climate pollution. And they have their company, Koch Industries, has really led the way in some of the biggest fines that have ever been imposed on a company in various years for in various kinds of pollution. So they've clashed with the laws, and they are working very hard as libertarians to weaken the laws.
Tell us the story of Scott Brown. I love the way you use this character to drive the narrative.
Well, he was running for the Senate from Massachusetts to take the place of Ted Kennedy, one of the great Democrats, in American politics, who had died. And people think of Massachusetts as a Democratic state, and nobody expected that the spot would be filled by this unheard-of Republican whose major claim to fame at that point was that he'd been a centerfold in a girly magazine, seen mostly naked. But behind the scenes, what happened was a huge amount of money was pouring in through organizations that looked like they were unconnected with kind of boring-sounding names, and that money was organized again by an operative working for the Kochs. And so what they were able to do with that sort of sneak attack was change the makeup of the U.S. Senate. That one seat made a huge difference. The Senate was at a tipping point. And by the time Obama and the White House figured out what was going on, it was too late. They hadn't really been fighting hard to hold on to that seat. They thought it was theirs. And they woke up with a huge surprise and realized they could no longer get legislation through the Senate.
Well, let's do a whip pan to the Supreme Court, because in that year they made a ruling of profound importance regarding the Citizens United case.
Well, this was 2010. And so, again, I mean, part of what I tried to do with this book was explain that things don't necessarily just happen. You know, what you see on the surface, there's usually a backstory. And so I spent years trying to figure out, well, what was really going on here? And that is true of the Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court, which is the one that has really changed American politics. It's the ruling that allows people to spend unlimited amounts of money on getting their candidate of their choice elected. And before that, there were limits. And so what changed the Supreme Court's point of view? Well, part of it was a tremendous amount of groundwork that was done by the Kochs and their allies. They built up an organization that litigated incessantly, creating all kinds of precedents until finally this was the big case. And again, they created these groups that you've never heard of that sort of militated for spending in elections. They described it as speech, not spending, free speech. And eventually they helped turn this final decision in 2010, which has changed the whole landscape in American politics, because people like the Kochs, who are billionaires, can now spend as much money as they want getting people elected.
Talking to the marvelous Jane Mayer, and Jane, you live in New York, you write for The New Yorker, you're a New York Times bestseller. There is one aspect of the Kochs' behaviour, which isn't a secret, and that's the largesse that one of them spends on cultural matters in New York.
Well, that's actually what caught my attention in the first place. I grew up in New York. I now live in Washington because I cover politics for The New Yorker, and it's the capital. So I've moved to Washington, but I was in New York one day, and I rounded a corner, and I saw at Lincoln Center, which I grew up going to concerts at, the name David Koch had been sort of chiseled into the side of the building. And I thought, David Koch, that's strange. I had, as a political reporter, been seeing his name associated with Tea Party spending in a very small way. I mean, there wasn't much coverage of it, but I thought, I wonder if anybody in Manhattan has any idea who these people are, because Manhattan's not really a Tea Party town. And I thought, wow, there is a story of connecting the dots here. We've got a brother who's sort of swanning around New York society and top circles of our cultural life, and also giving a ton of money to science and all the usual sort of things that you associate billionaire philanthropists with. Yet there's a secret side of his spending. He and his brother were secretly spending unbelievable amounts of money to undermine the Obama administration and promote a really radical form of right-wing politics.
Have you been able to quantify how much money they've spent in the last decade or so?
Well, it's hard to know, because so much of the money is quantified as charitable or spending, which is not, it's a kind of a category of money where you can't get all the statistics on it. It's hundreds of millions of dollars for sure. And you can add up what's interesting about the Kochs, and the reason they are especially potent, is they spend on in many different ways at once. So they spend on ideological philanthropy that pushes their point of view by subsidizing think tanks and university programs and all kinds of academics. As one of the second largest company that's privately held in America, they spend a huge amount on lobbying, that is spending on, you know, on the, pushing their point of view in Congress. And then they have a number of front groups that spend money on getting, you know, militating for their point of view by having grassroots rallies and people going door to door. And then they just spend, like most people spend who have a lot of money, on candidates. So with all of these categories of spending, it comes to tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions, depending on what period you look at. It's a phenomenal amount of money. And much of it is not immediately visible.
I love your phrase, weaponizing philanthropy.
Well, thank you. And that is what they've done that is such a change in the country. It wasn't just they. I mean, the book is about a handful of extraordinarily wealthy conservative families who felt that America was not going in the direction they liked. And they were unable to just win it in regular elections. Their point of view was not popular. So they weaponized their philanthropy. They poured money into charitable groups that were supposed to be tax deductible in many cases because they were doing the public welfare work. And in fact, these groups turned out to be another form of political weapon, pushing their point of view.
On the other side of this coin, though, we see, for example, the face of George Soros. Now, he's spent very large amounts, hasn't he?
Soros is the largest, and I have written for The New Yorker about George Soros, too, and I mentioned him a couple times in this book. He's the largest donor by far of sort of political, ideological philanthropy on the liberal side. He has something called the Open Society Institute. And he's been active not just in the U.S., but all around the world, particularly in sort of Eastern Europe and Russia, where he's pushing for more democratic governments. So that would be sort of, they would say, well, the left does it too. Within the United States, in 2004, Soros spent about $20 million to try to defeat George Bush, and it didn't work. And that was the high watermark of individual liberal spending. This year, to give you a little bit of a kind of a comparison, the Kochs and their allies have put together a group that's called Freedom Partners, which is spending $889 million. So you've got $20 million in 2004 for the liberals, $889 million for the conservatives in 2016. This kind of spending has just metastasized.
Let's go back to the origins of the Koch fortune, just as it's amusing and instructive to go back to the origins of the Trump fortune. Not that that's anything like the same magnitude, but I learned from you that the patriotic American father, talking of Charles and David, worked for the two of the big names of the 20th century, a certain Stalin and a fellow called Hitler.
Yeah, it's an irony given their politics. You know, the father was famously anti-communist later, but really, where did he make the beginning of his fortune? He built 15 refineries for Joseph Stalin in the first phase of the Soviet Union, and that was in the early 1930s. And at a time when the United States was in grave economic depression, Fred Koch, the father, became extraordinarily rich, first doing that, and then he looked elsewhere in the world and built with a partner a key refinery for Adolf Hitler right before the beginning, you know, as the Nazis were really building up their military machine before the start of World War II. And that refinery became key, according to authorities on this subject, because it could refine high-octane fuel, which was what was needed for the Nazi Air Force. So it was kind of a dubious start to this grand fortune, a kind of an untold story of where the money came from. But at any rate, Fred Koch, the father, became the richest man in Kansas, the state they were from, and the boys all inherited something like $300 million when he died. In the late 1960s. There were four boys. They're actually, when you talk about the Koch brothers, everybody thinks about Charles and David Koch as if they were sort of the only Koch brothers or Siamese twins. But in fact, they're four, and they had broken into two teams of sons, and they it was just an unbelievable amount of rivalry and really hatred in the family. The two teams of sons litigated against each other for 20 years, fighting over who would control the family business and and get a bigger share of the family fortune.
We often see similar court wrangles in this country with our billionaires. It tends to come with the territory, doesn't it?
I think the money is seen in some of these families as a measure of who the parents like the best and, you know, something other than just money, because really, who needs more than $300 million that they all got when they were young men and as inheritance, you know? And so it's all about who's on top and which one the parents love the most or whatever. But at any rate, they were one of the things I discovered while I was working on this book was there was an unpublished family history which had been commissioned by one of the brothers, and it describes the early years of the family and the sibling rivalry. And it was brutal in this family. I mean, the father was a huge, larger than life character who was very tough on these boys and believed in corporal punishment and would take a branch off a tree and strip it down and whip the little boys at various points when they were naughty. And so he was kind of an old school father. The family's roots were in Dutch. They were kind of, you know, old school European. And anyway, he was a tough dad and was determined to not spoil them, made them work at a very early age. And it was a very unhappy childhood in many ways.
I'm old enough to vividly recall the influence in the US of the John Birch Society. And their dad, of course, was involved with this ultra anti-communist group. Is there any evidence of anti-Semitism as well?
Well, I mean, you've got the father making his fortune partly by working for Hitler at a time when it was very clear to most of the world where Hitler was, at least, what his ideology was. And the partner that the father had at that time was known by the U.S. Justice Department as an agent of influence for Hitler and was very anti-Semitic himself. So you sort of pick up little bits of it. And then the father hired a nanny for his sons who turned out to be a fervid Nazi supporter herself. She was German. The family brought her back from Germany, and she raised the oldest of the two boys, which include Charles Koch, until they were, you know, at least five or six, whatever. And she was a huge Hitler follower. When Hitler invaded France, she said she needed to go back to Germany because she was so happy that she wanted to celebrate. So there's certainly a kind of strange environment in terms of those issues.
Let's look at the America they dream of. Low taxes, no gun control, minimum government, get rid of environmental restrictions. But one issue in which I must say I have a certain sympathy, they want to end the war on drugs. Does that sit easily with the others?
Well, it does in a way. I mean, if they are really pure libertarians, they are close to anarchists. And in fact, William F. Buckley, this founder of the modern conservative movement in the U.S., was, you know, looked down his nose at them. They were considered kind of fringe lunatics and described their movement as anarcho-totalitarian, meaning that, you know, they were so close to anarchy. They wanted to get rid of all kinds of laws having to do with behavior and everything else. So they also believed in very limited laws on prostitution, on suicide, on, you know, those kinds of personal freedom issues. And on the plus side of the ledger, if you're a liberal, they've been very much against most wars. So they just don't want the state to play much of a role. They prefer the big business be the power.
There's a paradox between their virulent opposition to Obama, whom they said would ruin America, to the fact that they've become immensely richer during the Obama's two terms.
It's absolutely true. Their fortunes have tripled during the Obama administration to the point where they're now each worth about $46 billion. They are tied for the fifth richest men in the country. And, you know, so they have done very well. But there's, to go back to one other thing I would like to say, which is about the paradoxes. They profess to be pure libertarians who believe in a tiny state, and for instance, as you mentioned, are against laws that control the use of and sale of drugs. Yet what they've done, when you take a look at it, is support candidates who have opposite points of view. Over and over again, and if you look at the Tea Party, it for instance, they have made a kind of a devil's deal with the far right-wing politicians who are in favor of all kinds of restrictions on personal freedom, such as limiting women's rights to their own reproductive decisions. When it comes down to it, the candidates they support are the ones that serve their financial interests. Their libertarianism always comes back to trying to free their corporation from regulations and lower their own taxes. And if a candidate supports that and opposes them on every other issue, they'll support that candidate. It always comes down to the bottom line for them.
One of the things I find fascinating is that you've identified the ring around them, you know, the other families, like, say, the Waltons of Walmart, the Mars Candy family, the founders of Amway. They're, you know, just as Warren Buffett, you know, leads a lot of investors to great success, it seems that a great and begs for ultra-rich Americans to pay more taxes, oddly enough, it looks as though the Koch brothers are seen as absolutely inspirational by other billionaire families.
Well, and that really is the trick of their influence also, which is Charles Koch is a very bright man. He went to MIT, and he's an engineer, and he looked at American politics and tried to figure out how do you have the maximum impact. And one of the things he did was realize, even though he has an extraordinary fortune himself, he could magnify it if he created a club of billionaires, and that's what they've done. And it started in 2003 or 2004. He started inviting others. Now it's become, it's one of the most powerful groups in American politics is the what they call the Koch Network, or Freedom Partners is its name now. And they get together twice a year in secret. They won't release the names of the other members, but they've got 400 to 450 of the richest conservatives in the country meeting and pooling their resources. So that's how you get this kitty of $889 million that they're ready to spend in this 2016 election cycle.
Many years ago, a young American with whom I was quite friendly, called Ralph Nader, wrote a book called Unsafe at Any Speed, which, of course, you know well. And the response of Detroit, of the big businesses, the big car industry, was to dig up dirt, or to try and dig up dirt on Ralph so they could blackmail him. Actually, Ralph lived such an excruciatingly simple and moral life, they failed utterly. But they've had a go at you, not Detroit, but the Koch brothers. They've tried to dig up dirt on you.
This is true, and it's funny you bring that up. I remember reading about that as I was growing up, about the Ralph Nader thing, and thinking, gosh, is that ever dirty? And yet there, you know, as a reporter, I found myself in something of a similar situation. It's true. I didn't realize it at first, but there turned out to be a kind of a skunk works operation to find dirt on me that was led, I've discovered belatedly, by a private detective who was hired by people working for the Kochs. And his name is Howard Safer. He was the former commissioner of police in New York City. And he had a small private investigative firm. And they worked on it for months looking for dirt. And
well, thank heavens you have the private life of a saint, Jane.
Oh, well, I'm glad it's this portion of my life. They actually did go back through my early boyfriends, apparently. I learned about some of the details later. But you know, what's scary is I thought I was fairly safe territory. I pay my parking fines and taxes, and I'm happily married. And I just didn't think I had many vulnerabilities. But it didn't really matter, because people like that can make something up. And so what they did was they tried to frame me as a plagiarist. And they went through 10 years of the things I've written, I believe with a computer, looking for phrases that were the same with other people's work. And they came up with four examples that they claimed were plagiarism. And so they were going to try to take down my reputation by planting a story with two different publications at the same time saying that I was a plagiarist. And they gave me overnight to respond. And it was terrifying. To tell you the truth, I really think it would have wrecked my reputation if this had gotten into print.
I think I think coming onto this program will do more damage to your reputation, Jane. And what I'm going to do to reward you for your courage is to give you our highest award. I don't give these out too often to guests, but when they do such great work above and beyond the call of duty, I give them a koala stamp. It's not a physical award, but it's a metaphoric one. So you can add that to your CV.
I would very much love that. Thank you very much.
Koala stamp.
Can I just say there was nothing to it, and none of the publications ran anything because it was untrue, but it could have been bad.
Jane, good on you. Jane Mayer, author of the bestseller Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, published in Australia by that valiant little publishing house, Scribe. Well, that's a wrap for the week, and let me remind you that whoever wins the election, our democracy is ripe, overdue for renovation of leadership, money, political parties. How the hell do we fix them? Listen to Late Night Live all next week on RM, and have a search wherever and whenever you podcast. Thanks to the team, Tim Jenkins, our technical engineer, producers Amrutha Slee, Stan Corrie, Anna Whitfield, Sasha Fegan, Gail Basario, and Mike Pritchard up here in Muswellbrook. Have a great weekend.